We have an informational meeting, Systems Approach to Healthcare, with Jeff Hetherington, Family Care, and Ruby Hutton from Oregon Care. So, Jeff, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm the president of Family Care Incorporated, which is a fully capitated contractor doing business under the state of Oregon for the Oregon Health Plan population. quick background, Family Care is the oldest Medicaid managed care company in the state now. We started in 1985 under the old physician care organization model. All we had to cover at risk was the physician services. When the Oregon Health Plan came along, we transformed ourselves into a full HMO operation and have been doing business there since. We serve about 13,000 clients in six of Oregon's counties. I also, for those of you who have seen me in different roles, am the executive director for the Osteopathic Physicians and Surgeons of Oregon, and have been around that one for way too many years. What I was asked to do today is to present to you an overview of the healthcare system, and I want to preface by what I'm saying is that I take off both of my lobbying hats when I do that. This is intended to be a discussion of how the healthcare system works, what the dynamics are within it, and as a sort of as a foundation for all of you to take a look at, if we're going to make decisions, then these are the things that might happen with this decision, or these are the things that might happen with another. And our intent here is to give you probably a better understanding of the choices that you're making and what the consequences of those choices might be as we move forward. So this happens to be a presentation that I do for a graduate program in health policy administration, and there'll be a test afterwards.
Good.
On the information. But this is the system.
Open book test. And we'll rely on Margie's notes.
Okay. Isn't that cheating?
And this lovely lady to my right, left, is Ruby Hutton, who is the Vice President for Government Covert Operations for Care Oregon.
Covert Operations?
Is that covert operations?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ruby Hutton, the Legislative and Public Affairs Director for Care Oregon, and wanted to make sure that as you had questions relative to the entire system, that I lended my support for this presentation in your committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, there are essentially five elements of the healthcare system. I'm going to talk about each one of them individually, but there is the demand side, there's access, there's quality, there's expense, and there's finance. And one of the things that I will emphasize over and over again as I talk about this is these are interrelated parts. None of them can be separated from the other. So whenever you tweak a piece of the system, what we're encouraging people to do is take a look at what you're tweaking, where it lies, and where it's going to affect other parts of the system. Most all of the definitions I will use here as I talk about the system will be neutral. People take a look at quality and they say, well, that means something. I'm going to give you some meanings that are basically universal. So they don't necessarily mean that quality is good. It just means that there's a specific definition that is pretty neutral and you can work within it. Okay, so with the demand part of the system, the definition that I use is any condition that presents itself to the healthcare system for diagnosis or treatment. So that's any condition at any part of the system. So if I go to the Walgreens and buy aspirin, you know, that is a condition that's presented itself for something. So it's any kind of a demand. There are a number of things that affect demand. The biggest one, of course, is the fact that we're alive. As long as we're alive, we will have health conditions come up, whether they're perceived or real, and that will create a demand that will present itself to the system. I liken this part of it is too. It's sort of like the Columbia River. It'll just keep flowing. As long as we have people living, we will have a demand on the system for health care. You can do all sorts of things with it, but that river just keeps on going until it reaches the sea, and the same is for health care. As long as you have people alive, you will have a demand on the system. Now, there are things that you can do to affect demand, you know, and I'll go those quickly. One is strategies for prevention, environmental factors, which you hear a lot about, cultural factors, change the culture in some areas. We have different cultures that have different ways of approaching the same kind of condition and how it approaches the system. And consumer expectations, which is a really big one, and I'll come back to that on several different occasions. But the way we have marketed to consumers, frankly, has changed the way that they think they need to enter the system and get a diagnosis or treatment. So as we market to consumers, we change the demand pattern. Even though, I mean, the constant is the fact that we're having health conditions develop, but we certainly do change it with the marketing system. The second piece is the access system that we create. And access is defined as the ability of the individual to enter and receive services from the healthcare system. And I underline the word the ability. Some people have an ease of ability to walk into the system. Some don't. It may be financial. It may be cultural. It may be distance. But access is defined as their ability to get into the system and get care. Some of the things that affect access are the mix of providers. I'll give you a quick example. You know, 40 years ago, 50% of our physicians were family practitioners. You know, now it's down to about 15%. Well, that mix certainly changes the ability and the way we access the system for health care. Not saying it's good or bad, that's a whole different discussion, but it certainly changes the way we do it. The number of facilities and how far away they are for care. In Portland, I have a number of choices of hospital facilities, nursing home facilities, and so on, where I can go for my care. In Enterprise, Oregon, or Christmas Valley, it's a whole different decision process I have to go through if I want facility-type care. Insurance. Whether it be private insurance, federal government, state insurance, certainly has a lot to do with how we get into the system. If we have to think about paying the entire bill on our own, our ability, even though it's perceived, to get services certainly does change. And I mentioned co-payments here because co-payments are one of the ways where we control access and how people move into the system. And the other piece that's pretty important is level of reimbursement among providers. This is starting to show up more and more, and I'm sure you're aware of the comments that have come out of the medical community with regard to Medicare reimbursement. You know, as Medicare reimbursement to physicians has gone down, physicians are starting to change the number of Medicare patients they'll see. Some of them are closing their practices. So as you tweak reimbursement, particularly at the government level, to different types of providers, you change whether or not they are open or closed. Now, the other way you can change that, of course, is by regulation. You've got the EMTALA laws on hospitals. They don't have any choice. You walk in there, they have to see you, they have to evaluate you and at least stabilize you before they send you out the door. You know, beyond that, whatever they do depends on the level of reimbursement that they may receive and what the attitude of the physicians are. On the physician side, physicians are making hard decisions about how many of the government-funded insureds that they will see because the level of reimbursements now has gotten so low. I think I talked about that, the level of reimbursement among payers. Is part of that mix. The third area is quality. And quality is the definition and measurement of how good we want our health care to be. Now, understand that you can set that at any level you want. If you decide that how good we want our health care to be is that we don't really care about the number of fetal deaths that we have, because we don't have prenatal care, That would be a definition of quality. It wouldn't be mine, but it would be a definition. If you decide that you want your fetal death rate to be at less than 1%, that would be another definition of quality. So it really is a matter of what we decide about how good we want our health care to be. And I would make an editorial comment here. This is something within the healthcare system that we have done the least amount of work on in terms of public policy. We don't do this. Where we allow the definition of quality to occur is at the individual level, and mostly in terms of consumer expectations. So it's the consumer that gets to decide how good I want my health care to be. And give you an example, there are certain hospitals that market themselves as being the hospital to have cancer care or the hospital to have babies. Now, I'm not objecting to that at all, but when that sticks in the patient's mind, then they'll darn well go to that hospital if they have cancer, or that hospital if they have are going to have a baby. And so that's how they've defined, you know, quality. We haven't done that as a society in any way, shape, or form. And if you're going to have a quality measurement that you do as a at a societal level, you have to have certain standards. You know, what's your foundation for quality? How are you going to measure your progress? And what kind of outcomes do you really want? One of these days, I would hope we would get to that point, but it certainly isn't going to be anytime soon. I'll make another editorial comment. The only place that Oregon ever got close in terms of this discussion was when we put the Oregon Health Plan together. That was the time in which we had a very good discussion in 1989, and we started talking about what is the standards we want to set for the number of uninsured we have, the number of people without care. How are we going to measure it, and what kind of outcomes are we looking for? So there was an active discussion about, we want to cover X, we want to bring our uninsureds down to here, we want to make sure we cover women who are pregnant, we want to make sure we have certain immunization levels. Within the Oregon Health Plan has been the one area that we've actually had those discussions, and you've seen some measurable differences in the outcome for the people who are carried who are covered under the Oregon Health Plan in this regard.
But doesn't that, though, presuppose you have the resources to do what you say you want to do?
You have to make those choices also, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to, I mean, within this, if it's just sort of like if you make a definition of how good you want your ride to be from your home to the Capitol, you have to make sure that you plan to have the money to buy the car you want.
Yeah.
That's a different kind of a discussion, but yeah, you do have to put the resources in to make sure you get the outcomes that you've set out.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, yes, Senator Mance.
Jeff, who is responsible for the quality question?
Well, isn't that interesting? I think we all are. I think the legislature has a role to play in that. I think government has a role to play in that one, in terms of leading the discussion, because you can bring all the parties to the table. You certainly can do that in terms of your government-funded programs. I think you can do that in terms of your employee benefit programs for state employees. But someone has to bring the group together, and someone has to, and I'll talk about this a little later, about some of the things that you do if you're going to have long-term strategies about health care improvement.
Good. Thanks.
Expense. Now, this is a little bit of a tricky one here, because people think of expense as being what I pay out of my pocket, and that's not what I'm talking about here. What I'm talking about is the actual expense incurred for delivering the service. And if you want to think of it from a business point of view, think about it in terms of supplies, salaries, overhead, capital expenses. Essentially, it is the unit cost for the service in a business mode. So that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about expense. So if I walk in to a doctor's office, they see me, send me back out the door. What was the cost involved in that physician's office for that service in terms of salaries? And we're talking about the staff salaries, the rent, the light, all of that. So that's the expense side of the equation.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Yes. Senator.
This is an issue that's concerning to me, Mr. Chair. I think that we have a cost item in there that's directly related to how the service is being paid for that is helping to mask the real cost of delivering the service.
Which is?
Which is the billing practice, the payment, delay in payment, the additional help you have to hire to collect the money.
Right. That would fall. That'd be part of the unit cost. Now I'm not here to speak to how you fix individual pieces, but I would say just in terms of when you're considering expense, if the rebilling is a significant part of what's driving some of the expense, which in my opinion I think it is in some cases, then if you were going to change the expense side, you'd have to address that directly.
Thank you.
And I want to make a delineation between the bill charge, in other words, the bill you get in the mail, and what the expense is. There's all sorts of things that are different between a bill charge and the expense of the service. And a lot of that has to do with providers balancing among payers. You make it up from one payer where you don't get it from another. And the final one is finance. And the definition of the finance part of the system is how, by whom, and to whom payments are made. Do that again. How, by whom, and to whom payments are made. Most of us assume that this is a fairly straightforward process, that the actuaries sit down and figure out the numbers and then the payments go out to the payers. In fact, what it really is more a system of politics and negotiation. And what happens in terms of the politics and negotiation is there are three major payers out there. There's the federal government, there's the state government, there's the commercial and private insurers, and then there's individuals. Now, the individuals is a small part of the market. But what happens in the way we design our finance system for healthcare is the federal government makes the decision about how much they're going to pay. Supposedly, but I wouldn't believe it personally, they make it determination of what the actual expense is that's being generated. The state makes the same kind of determination. Most of the time, the feds and the state make their determination based on what's in their budget. And at that point, then, the commercial and private insurers are left with the rest of the bill. And that's how the system works in terms of finance. So when we say politics and negotiation, you got the political side, and where most of the negotiation goes on is at the commercial level, between the various providers and the various payers. Now, an important rule that I want to say about expenses is the healthcare system will always collect its costs. And don't ever forget that. And that's why I go back to, where the payers are. The healthcare system will always collect its cost because some entity always pays the bill. And in that regard, in a global statement, there is no such thing as uncompensated care in the healthcare system.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. In a minute.
So, Jeff, isn't that an extremely strong argument for government intervention? In the sense that the healthcare system itself creates its own cost structures, participates in fragmenting the system, and as you say, healthcare systems will always collect their costs, but
I would say it's a very strong argument for the government to pay its full share of the bill, number one, and number two, to pay the bill intelligently.
Well, Mr. Chairman, in argument.
Yeah.
And I wrote this note to myself. Who created the bill in the first place? Who are the participants receiving the services, and whose responsibility is it to pay the bill? I understand the healthcare system will collect all of its monies they feel are owed to them, but the system is much larger than this in terms of who gets subsidized health care and who doesn't get health care at all.
Right.
How the system is created. For instance, when in the 80s, we had certificates of need in place before you could build a hospital. We no longer have those. And now we have large-scale expansions of certain facilities within the state. And that's completely unregulated at this juncture by the legislature.
Correct.
So those kinds of questions, and how we, as a legislature, view the entire system that is compensating itself at some point. So
I have all sorts of ways of answering that question.
Well,
some of it is in the presentation.
Okay.
And if I could, and I will address some of those, and if you want to follow up with some questions. But what you're talking about here is how the access system is designed, which is basically the provider-based system. And the access system basically has followed the money. And so if government's going to intervene, then government needs to, my comment is that the way government redesigns the access system is to pay attention to how it's paying out its money.
Okay.
To whom.
And now, I have to intervene here for a minute because I read that entirely differently than Senator Minnis, because what I'm seeing, some entity always pays the bill. It could be the prison system is the entity that pays the bill. That's what I'm looking at.
Correct.
That the taxpayers ultimately and the ratepayers will pay the bill, either in the emergency room or in the prison system or somewhere.
Or the private employer. I mean, generally,
someone's going to pay the cost.
Yeah, who's covering the bill right now is commercial.
The point I'm making
is commercial.
That people, even if you're well insured, rarely participate in the cost of their own health care.
Right.
And the question that you raised earlier about identifying the actual unit cost for a particular service is probably one of the most obscure discussions that we'll ever have. And I was going to ask the question, who actually follows those costs? Because I know full well when I go to my physician, I have no idea what it costs my insurance company or me. And I, because I have good insurance, have little participation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, you are right. Nobody really follows that part of the system.
Okay. Senator Shields.
I was fascinated when Senator Minnis said that this creates a strong argument for government intervention. Because I'm kind of convinced that this all creates a strong argument for kind of a government kind of universal health care. I mean the quote that I got lately, and I'd be glad for you to argue it away if you can, is that somebody pointed out to me that if we actually had a system that we debated so much 10 years ago, that we would actually be paying as a nation a smaller percentage of our gross national product for health care today than we are under the present system. Is that true or not?
I don't know if that's true or not. I'll make a comment that if you're talking about universal health care, really the only part of the system you're talking about is the finance system. And then you'd have to make an assumption that you would design the finance system in such a way is that it would set up a rational access, a delivery system, that it would have an open discussion about what the quality of the system would be, that you'd have some control over costs, and that you would understand exactly how you should meet the demands of the public in a way that met their demands and not their expectations. Now, that's, if you're going to put it all together, that's what you have to do. I will tell you that where I do this particular lecture every year is up in Canada, and they have a universal health care system, and they always say, well, our system's a mess.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason why it's a mess is because most of what they focus on is what they can afford. And so most of the decisions up there are budget-driven and not system-driven. So, you know, it really does. Now, this is strictly my opinion, but I don't think it matters whether you have a multi-payer system or a single-payer system. It's the question is whether or not you have someone paying attention to the whole system and how it works.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. That's very interesting.
That's something that I've always maintained. If you have bad apples, you don't get rid of the bad apples by just shifting the types of charges or the types of billing or the things like that, because the person that would cheat under one system will cheat under another system. They'll figure out a way to do it. And so it takes a combination of more than that to really control a system. You have to have also control it to answer some of the problems that you have when somebody is finally caught doing something that they shouldn't be doing, and not just a slap on the hand, but something severe enough that it lets it be known that that's not a profitable thing. You weed those people out of the system. That's really the only way to control it.
Well, in conjunction with that, it was on the McNeil Lehrer report, I think, last night, where someone was talking about how it was absolutely impossible to keep honesty in the system of billing, that it is a multi-billion dollar a year loss, because entities, in fact, the hospital group that's coming into Springfield had to pay a $1 billion fine several years ago for fraudulent billing of the system. So speaking of bad apples, I think you gotta, you know, how do we control the entire system in terms of fraud, not just the people who use it, but the people who are the providers in it, who are billing?
Well, Mr. Chair, this is a little bit off the presentation, but let me answer the question. And it may seem a little bit... you're always going to have a bad apple, but I think one of the problems with the system right now is that we encourage and, in fact, almost demand our providers game the system in order to make sure that they pay their bills. In order to get things, I mean, we have such a complicated system to wend your way through, you know, trying to get a bill paid, and how many times you have to bill it. You know, physicians, human nature, you know, you'll figure out a way to get what you need to get in order to survive. And the federal government, the Medicare system, is extremely onerous and extremely complicated. The Oregon Health Plan system actually is not that onerous, but it doesn't pay very much. And the commercial system, you know, it's how many plans, how many benefit packages do you have out there? And the physician's sitting there going like, how do I make sure I cover, you know, my expenses? And the hospitals do the same thing. So we have a very complicated system, and people, in my opinion, most of them are just trying to do their best to figure out how to make it work. And they make mistakes. And I'll tell you that, particularly in terms of the fraud and abuse era, and now you'll hear about the Privacy Act, it's hard not to break a rule, even if you're just billing for the services that you actually rendered.
One other thing about demand is defined as the ability to get something, not a wish, and so I think you touched on that at some point.
Yes, yeah.
So, okay. Yeah.
Senator Shields is not here, but I want to make it perfectly clear for the record that when I said government intervention, I did not mean socialism or any form of socialism or consumer protection. And I guess that my observation that much of the healthcare system is extremely fragmented and the access to information relevant to true cost is obscure, and to the extent that people understand the actual cost and there have some buy into, you know, the actual cost and participate in it, I think that drives the free enterprise system and the economy in terms of marketability of certain services.
Right. Yeah. I was really confused about your statement, so I thank you for clearing that up.
Yeah, and I guess I tried to raise the question of cost shift, and I don't know, you know, people really come unglued when the pharmacists say we have to absorb all of that voluntary copay, and the Safeway pharmacists are very concerned about that, as are the Rite Aid pharmacists, and that's a cost shift. That's a cost.
That's correct.
So we can't talk about cost without cost shift.
Right, and that's part of the financing side of the system.
Yeah.
So what the providers have done is they figured out which part of the finance system they can bill to get the money to cover their costs. So what some providers do is they overbill, or they bill far more than their expenses to one provider, because they know they can collect, and most of that is by contract, quite frankly, because you can't bill the government different than you bill the private insurer. But if you know that the government's going to pay you X no matter what you bill, then you just raise your bill charges up until you get some sort of a payment from the private area. And that's how the system has to work, or you go out of business. Let me talk a little bit about I'll reiterate here, you know, that finance is who pays, how much, and to whom. And I want to give you some examples of how the system works and some of the things that we talk about in terms of the system. So I've got some myths and truths here. And here's a couple that float around this legislature a lot. You can control demand by limiting access. Another one is you can control expenses by limiting access. You can control expenses by reducing reimbursement. And managed care controls health care costs. Now, those are some statements that are certainly active in the Oregon Health Plan discussion. Let me talk about each one of those. One is, can you control demand by limiting access? Well, you can't stop the aging process, and you can't stop the living process, so access isn't going to make a dent in that. What you can do is you can change consumer expectations, which we have done in some cases and which we have failed to do in others. And you can redirect demand to the more cost-effective healthcare services. But you can't limit demand. You can't control demand by limiting access. You can control expenses by limiting access.
Now, wait a minute. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Who is you?
You is all of us. Whoever's making the decision.
Okay. I watched last night.
Yeah.
The nightly news is a great place to watch the commercials for people, you know, the aging population.
Right.
And I was particularly interested in one, and I won't name the brand, but it's a pain medicine that is considered to be the ultimate. And it's interesting because I was denied access to that pain medication when it first came out. And I asked my doctor for it, and he said, sure, I'll write the prescription. Well, the HMO refused it. They didn't give it to me, and I was a little bit outraged that I couldn't get that. Well, right. Once I did get it, I realized that it was no better than aspirin, as far as I'm concerned. So it was interesting, but they are touting that as the end all. And so you're talking about raising expectations. I mean, how do you compete with the advertisements that market these medicines that are extremely expensive and questionable? That's creating expectations.
Yeah, I will tell you that the first line of defense has to be the physician on that, and the physicians have to be, first of all, educated as to what evidence-based pharmacology looks like, and then they have to be willing, and this is tough, they have to be willing to say to the patient, you know, aspirin or Advil will do just as good as this other drug will, and then stand firm. But the trouble is that, you know, if we don't get what we want in this society, what do? Pick up our marbles and go somewhere else to someone who will give it to us. And essentially in healthcare right now, sooner or later you'll find someone who will give it to you and someone who will pay for it, which goes back to Senator Menace's comment.
You're absolutely right, Jeff, except that there are certain medical conditions, I'll say this kind of an advertisement, that I do believe that the physicians need to be in a position to make the choice with respect to the best medications, because it's very commonly believed that aspirin or buffered aspirin will help an arthritic patient, but over time, taking aspirin will rot your stomach out and give you bleeding ulcers and other kind of side decision. You know, so the arbitrary decisions of formularies and government officials in those respects sometimes can do great harm and cost more money than
right. And I would certainly agree with that, Senator Menace. I use the term evidence-based,
right.
Which means that, you know, the physician has, you know, all of the information that they need that's factual to make the decision as to what medicines to provide. Okay, the next myth I was going to handle was you can control expenses by limiting access. First, remember, demand will find a way into the system one way or another. It's just like the Columbia. You can put a dam up, you can divert it, but that water's going to keep coming. So limiting access won't stop that. In order to have access control expenses, you have to manage it, which means you have to direct it to the most appropriate level of care in terms of both quality and efficiency, and you have to have some sort of planning about how your access system looks. If you're going to control expenses, you have to address the access system and make sure that it's set up so that it handles the demand that's out there, not the demand that's expected. You can control expenses by reducing reimbursement. And we have to remember, reimbursement is the way you design the access system. If you put all the money into one sector, they'll be fat and happy. The other sectors won't be there. I'll give you a perfect example about how we have patterned reimbursement that has created an access system that we have today. We pay our specialists more than we pay our family physicians. That's just the way the system works. Well, the bottom line is when you're coming out with $200,000 worth of expenses from medical school and you take a look at where do I want to specialize, one of your decisions is going to be economic. And so if you're looking at an annual income as a family practitioner of $105,000 to $110,000 versus going into surgery where you can make three times that kind of money, where are you going to go? You know, some of these are very practical decisions. I don't want to paint physicians as greedy or anything like that, but they're making practical decisions about quality of life and their ability to pay their bills. And when you have these huge debts coming out and you look at being on call 7 days a week, having to handle all of the things you have to handle as a family practitioner versus some of those where you have adequate backup and you can take time off and you've got the time to go off and enjoy life and your family, you know, we've designed a reimbursement system that basically asks everybody to be a specialist. As a for instance, in this system. So when you say you can control expenses by reimbursement, the answer is yes, you can. But that's if you think it through. Different payers have different access designs. We certainly saw that with when HMOs and managed care came into being in the late 70s and 80s. Then we started using our payment system and our co-payments system to design how we wanted people to get into the system. And frankly, to some extent, it worked. The whole demise of of managed care. I could talk about it in a different venue, but basically how the feds, how the state, and how the commercial people design their access system really is a determination they make individually and not over the whole plan. If you plan your reimbursement to direct and manage access, you will actually reduce your expenses. Thank you very much.
You got to be a doctor, John.
And then the question is does managed care control cost? And if anybody wants, I'll set this up to ask me about the managed care system in general. We can talk about it, but let me get through this piece first. The answer is only if the care management is based on a whole system design. And that means that you design the managed care system to take into account what the demands are, what your access system needs to look like, what kind of quality you want out of the system to make sure that you have the outcomes, the health outcomes you're looking for. If you control your costs and if you design your reimbursements so that the providers you want to deliver care actually will. So you have to do a whole system design on that, not just say we're going to design a limited access system, which is what managed care sort of got to. Only if the payer agrees to the design, and that's really odd, but it's really the payer. You talk about the both the state and the feds. You know, the payers sort of sometimes get forced into a particular system design. And on the commercial side, how they get forced into that is by the employer who's buying the policy saying, this is the way I want it to look, and this is all I'm willing to spend. So you may have a good design, and this is really what happened to managed care. You may have a good design to how to manage care within a system, and then the employer or the payer comes in and says, yeah, but I don't want to pay for that. All I want to pay for is this. And at that point, then you start upsetting, you know, what might be a rationally designed plan. That makes sense? If you're going to design a rational healthcare system, I'll move through this one rather quickly, or we'd be here all afternoon. You have to have explicit, and this is the whole system design Senator Shields was talking about, you have to have explicit community agreement on what the values are of the system you want. You have to have long-term strategies in place, and you have to have long-range planning. We're not a society that likes to do that. We sort of live for the immediate. But if you were going to design a real rational system, and that would be one that was cost-effective, had high quality to it, and move people through the system in a way that met their expectations in a reasonable way, this is what you'd have to do to put it into place. I list some of the values. This is just for your information. I'm not advocating any of them, but these are the kinds of values you hear when you start talking about healthcare. One is the dignity and care of the patient is paramount. One is prevention is the first step in healthcare. Healthcare should be available to all. Medical decisions should be made between the patient and provider. Providers should be fairly compensated for their services. All financing should go for delivery of services and not profits. Long-term planning of the system resources is essential. Now, you could come up with another long list of what we believe is important to a healthcare system, but at some point we need to make some decisions if you want to have a rational system that's cost-effective.
Is there a reason you didn't give us that?
Oh, it's not in there? No, there's not a reason that's not in there. I can furnish that. I probably hit the delete button once too often as I was taking out the extraneous slides.
Because that I think is...
You know, I think, Mr. Chairman, it's kind of a presentation that's very valuable to me because, Jeff, you raised some interesting points. I know, for instance, in forensic pathology, trying to attract medical students into forensic pathology is almost impossible, and they're projecting, I think, about an 80% deficit of physicians going into forensic pathology because you go to work as a state medical examiner here, your salary is $120,000 a year, and we're one of the lowest in the nation for paying our top forensic pathologists. So when you do come out of medical school, very few people do go into that kind of a field, although it doesn't really fit directly into this. As a legislature, you know, one of the questions we might ask is there a way that we can incent or pay for medical school for some students or provide scholarships for medical professionals?
Well, the answer would be yes.
All right.
But again, you have to ask, what do you want first? And then how do you pay for it?
Exactly. And I know we did this back in the 80s. We had some endowed chairs that we funded at OHSU and some other kinds of things to do to incent certain kinds of research. So it's conscious decisions that we could make.
Okay. Let me talk a little bit about long-term strategies that I believe need to be put in place if you're going to design one. One is you have to make quality improvement the foundation for how you measure your success. If you don't do that, you're really sort of fishing in the wind and responding to people's wishes more than anything else. Two, you have to design a delivery system that is based on the need for services. Three, you adopt a provider payment system that is based on the expected need for services. And I would submit to you, we don't have these here. you adopt an equitable financing system, which means that you figure out a way so everybody contributes, you know, their fair share into the system to pay for these services. You hold every segment of the healthcare industry accountable for their costs. Goes back to Senator Menace's point.
Now, you mentioned the early days of the Oregon Health Plan. Were those last things considered? Were they the foundation of the health plan, the long-term strategies?
Everything except the last bullet point on this particular slide, frankly, was considered. When we designed the Oregon Health Plan, here's in short form what we said. Number one, we defined the fact that we had a problem. We had a problem with access. We had uncontrolled costs. People were going to the wrong places for care in terms of they were basically using the emergency room, which we know is expensive. We had a high level of uninsured. We had a low rate of immunizations among this population. We had problems with prenatal care with this population. And so when we designed the system, we put the quality measures in place in terms of how we wanted to pay for and ensure that we had the right care delivered at the front end, and that's the prioritized list. So what we said when we built the prioritized list is we're going to say these things are the most important from 1 to 700, and we're going to pay for the most important things first. So we actually designed both a quality measure and a payment measure right up front to design the access system. Then the other thing we said is we're going to redesign how we pay our providers to make sure that the care we want, which is basically from physicians, and I don't want to leave out the other ancillary providers, but basically from physicians, that we pay the physicians adequately so they'll actually spend the time to see the patient, because we were paying our physicians so little at that time that they basically said, we can't afford to see these people, or we can only afford to see a small percentage of them. And so, you know, we addressed all of those issues when we put the Oregon Health Plan together. And I would say that this is an editorial comment on my part, but there's comments out there, the Oregon Health Plan is out of control when it's broken and all of that. And I couldn't disagree with that statement more. I think the Oregon Health Plan worked exactly like we designed it to. The costs that we find in the Oregon Health Plan mimic the costs in the private sector. And what we have right now is a budget crisis. And what the budget crisis is doing is taking the Oregon Health Plan to a point, the lack of revenue, where it won't operate. It's sort of like trying to feed water into a gas tank. You know, the car won't operate at that point. So then the question is, what do we do in the meantime? But frankly, I would say the Oregon Health Plan has worked quite well, and the factors that are causing us to take a look at it are pretty much external, not internal at this point.
Okay. Now, what about the last one, though? You said
one after.
Oh, the one after that is just the title page that I used.
No, I'm sorry. No.
Oh.
Hold every segment of the health.
Oh, hold every segment of the healthcare industry accountable for their cost. What about that? I wish you would have just left that one alone. We go back to Senator Menace's comment, you know, as to what expenses and costs are reasonable and what aren't. And I think you do have to have the industry account for why it wants to spend the money the way it spends. You know, how many hospitals, you know, do you need in a particular area? How many MRIs do you need in a particular area? How many specialists do you need in an area? Versus primary care, for instance. And I think that's the way you start to address, you know, the accountability of the industry.
You mentioned, Senator Menace, that the legislature no longer has, there doesn't have to be a certificate of need. I've received a request from McKinsey-Willamette Hospital to write a letter of recommendation to the Attorney General asking approval for Trident, whatever the name of that new hospital is, to come in and replace McKinsey-Willamette. Now, that kind of surprised me when I got this letter, because I didn't, there's an existing hospital, but that will be of a much greater magnitude, and so there seems to be some certificate of need problem an issue in the local community.
There may be. I will have to say that I'm not familiar with what's available or required out there for hospitals to build new facilities.
The point I was getting at is that there is some control over not allowing hospitals to move into an area where, you know, arbitrarily, apparently there does have to be either a replacement or a certificate of need for a new hospital.
Do you have an answer to that?
Certificate of need.
Okay.
Do we have a certificate of needs for a hospital now?
Yes.
We do. What did we do in the 80s when we repealed the law?
Yes, I think that's accurate. Someone from the hospital.
No,
I can see I drew a crowd.
Yeah, you did. Yeah. But it's all being televised, so people are at home watching.
I think you'd have to ask the hospital industry, but my memory is that we used to have what was called the State Health Planning and Development Agency, SHPDA, and it did the Certificate of Need process. And as I recall, the legislature disbanded the agency because after so many years, every Certificate of Need that was applied for had been approved. And so all you were doing was spending money to push paper.
So perhaps by recollection.
Mr. Chair, I think that's right in the hospitals. It's the nursing homes that have the Certificate of Need still in process.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That was incorrect.
Okay, so your bottom line conclusion, which was an editorial comment, is that the health plan is not intrinsically flawed. It's more of a budget crunch, a budget problem than it is a delivery system.
Correct.
Is that your bottom line?
Let me put a period on the end of that sentence, and that we are really concerned and certainly want to work with the legislature to make sure whatever decisions you make, which will probably involve eligibility and benefits, don't upset the delivery system in such a way that you end up with unintended consequences. And I'll give you an example, if I may. The emergency board in November, I don't want to go to that one. I want to go to the one that has to deal with the House Bill 5100, which basically cut prescription drugs out of the standard population, which happens on March 1. So as of March 1, you may have insurance, but you won't have any prescription benefits for about 100,000 people. Now, that was a way of supposedly limiting your expenses. Here's the bad news from a perspective that we explained to several legislators after this happened. Number one is the information that we, and when I say we, the health plan contractors developed, was that without prescription drugs, utilization of hospital resources and physician resources will go up by about 85%. So for the $50 per member per month that you are saving on prescription drugs, you will probably spend about 42 of that in the hospital and physician system. And that's if you had them in a managed care plan. If you have them under open cards, it may be higher. So what we want to do is to make sure that we all talk about what are the real consequences, because you intended to save $50 per member per month. What you're going to save is about $8. So that wasn't where you wanted to go in terms of solving your budget numbers. There are other ways to maybe get your budget numbers to get closer to $50, but that takes really some thoughtful discussion. And so where we're really looking to the legislature for, what we're looking for the legislature for, is to sit down and talk with us, particularly those of us in the delivery system, understanding we do have axes to grind, but we can probably walk you through the system and show you where all of the consequences are better than anybody else in this system.
Senator Mast.
Well, I don't know where to start. But I think that summing up everything you said, to me, the thing that I do agree with is that the legislature needs to be engaged in a thoughtful discussion about the whole health care question, whether it's the Oregon Health Plan as a public health care system or health care in general. And I do disagree with you with respect to the Oregon Health Plan, whether or not it is broken. I think it is woefully broken. And I think it's been plagued by the desire to expand the population served to the point where the soup is thinned down so much that your provider reimbursements are low and you simply can't get to the place you'd like to go. And the legislature's not really good oftentimes in making hard decisions in a limited resource environment. And we need to get better at doing that and making conscious decisions. But I do think there are things that we can do by having thoughtful discussions and helping to drive health care policy. For instance, if I get a sore throat and I'm wondering whether or not I have strep throat, I can do a couple of things. I can, go to my physician if I can get an appointment and get in to see the physician early enough, and that's going to cost me X amount of dollars. Or I can go to one of the urgent care clinics that has, you know, availability during the day, and I make a series of choices, or I can wait until it is full-blown strep throat laid up in an emergency room. But there are ideas that may be out there to help provide accessibility to lesser-cost health care earlier that we're not doing now. For instance, do we need a physician in many of those cases? Are nurse practitioners available? Can they practice in these areas? We restricted them years ago. Nurse practitioners would have certain access to script writing authority in rural parts of the state. I'm not sure if they do now in the urban portions of the state. But expanding access to health care through the use of nurses and nurse practitioners, the ability to write a prescription for an antibiotic with a subsequent follow-up to my physician, et cetera, may lower costs, may give me as a consumer more options. And I see that as a bit of an interesting problem, because if you want to go to an urgent care clinic in East Multnomah County, it's open 7 days a week, but only for certain hours. We rarely have, to my knowledge, urgent care clinics that are open 24 hours a day, where you have people that are staffing that might limit access through emergency rooms, et cetera. So I think we do have to have a thoughtful discussion about these issues.
Well, I guess I would also say that the cost, I go back to what you said, someone's going to pay the cost. And if you go to the emergency room, then your insurance company, your private rates are going to pay the cost of care. So you can't just access those more costly things and assume that, you know, it's free. It isn't, because someone will pay it. It's a cost shift. Cost shifts are one of the most, it's an unintended consequence, but I think it's one of the more dreaded forms of lack of cost control that we have, is a cost shift to prisons, to emergency rooms, and so on.
Yes, okay. I would agree with you.
Senator Fisher.
Yeah, I just wanted to say a thing or two, and I agree with Senator Minnis that part of it is the legislature, part of it has been an unworkable tension in the state capitol that hopefully is in our past, and we can proceed on to a little more congenial dealings, trying to get at the saving of our population as much as we can in their health care programs and other programs that are very necessary to them, in a different manner than we've been able to approach it prior to that. However, I would say this, and I was on the waiver application committee. The dentist came in with a plan that would save considerable money and did it on their own and got it to where they could keep people with reasonable dental care and do it. I specifically asked in that committee for the other medical professions to come in and give us some of that same thing. Did we have one of them do it? No, every one of them came in and stonewalled for getting their car, keeping their money up the same where it was. So I'm not going to absolve them 100% in the problem we're having now, because it better behoove everybody out there to be coming in and starting to fess up with places, because you know better than anyone else what we can do and still maintain some reasonable health for our people in a time when the dollars are scarce. And that's what it's going to take. It's going to take cooperation from everyone, and not only in the medical field, but everyone in the whole entire field of government spending. And we've had a bunch of stonewallers around for a long period of time in many different arenas. And frankly, decisions like this, where maybe something is taken away in total, is going to be the answer that you're going to get out there, which isn't really the answer that we ought to have, simply because we don't always know exactly how to do it ourselves as non-professionals. So in and that the professions themselves won't fess up and help out, we wind up doing things that aren't the best answer all the time. And so I would engender from you and from everyone out there that we're dealing with on these budget problems to get into the action and come forward and say, what can we do in your best estimation? Where can we make some savings, and where can we put the money so they'll do the best job that we possibly can. There was ample evidence that there's money to be saved in the prescription program for the Oregon Health Plan. Now, whether cutting 100,000 people just out of drugs was the right answer or not, I'm with you, I don't believe it was. But I do believe that there are savings to be made in that drug program.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher, I couldn't agree with you more. I think one of the things that, from the health plan contractor's point of view, that we're really after two things. Number one is we do want people to understand the whole system before we move forward, and that's why we've spent time doing this. The second thing that is of grave concern to me, and I think it certainly drives a lot of the debate, is you all have to have good data, and so do we, before you make decisions. And if you don't have good data, it's hard to make good decisions. And right now, a lot of that data is not available. And I would say, from, if I could be so bold, is that one of the things the legislature has to do is to demand that the agencies who are generating that data give it to you straight up and honest and accurate. And I can't be more blunt than that, but you're not getting it. Okay. At this point, and it's hard for you to make decisions until you get that. And one of the examples I'll give you is on this whole thing about the standard population and drugs. You know, the first thing we got back from from the actuary that serves the state, you pay him millions of dollars, was there is absolutely no utilization increase when you take drugs away from people. Now, that's the most ridiculous statement that anybody could have made. They made it in writing. But when you have that kind of information coming through the agency and then to you, I don't know how you can make a good decision. And so, I mean, that is step number one for the legislature, to insist that you get accurate and complete data in the system.
Okay.
And until you do that, it's going to be hard to make any decisions.
I want to come back to that in just a minute. Senator Shields.
I'm so blown away by what he said. I want to pursue that also, but maybe you'll pick it up in a minute, and if you don't, I'll continue. I wanted to follow up on Senator Fisher's question, because I didn't have a chance to sit on the committee he sat on, the waiver committee, and yet he was referring to the dental folks coming in and offering up something, and by the time it got to me, I hear, you know, there's no good deed goes unpunished. I mean, you offer up something and they take everything, and the folks at Stonewalled got everything, and I'm just kind of wondering how would, I mean, apparently the wisdom out there was Stonewall to save yourself. See what happened to the people that offered to come up with a cost-saving plan. We nailed them to the wall, took them to the cleaners. How would you come up with a system that actually would engender enough trust in us or in this system or an e-board or the legislature so that people will actually offer up cost savings when they don't obviously trust us enough to do it?
You want me to answer that question?
Yes, answer that. That's why you're paid the big bucks.
I'm going to put you under oath now.
This is why Ruby is up here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, this kind of takes me back a bit to my banking days, and some of you were here during that time. And it was a time when
that sounds like the Stone Age.
When the industry didn't work together. And so the financial services industry did not work together, and I think that's part of our dilemma as an industry. We've tried very hard, and Jeff's done, I believe, a very good job of sharing with you the dynamics of the industry and all the pieces here inherent in this presentation that he gave you today. But the individual pieces of the industry really need to come together and begin to work on kind of a whole health system. And so we have jointly, as health plans, because we're interdependent on all of the pieces of the system as health plans, So we have to have doctors, we have to have nurses, we have to have hospitals, we have to have dentists, we have to have mental health. All of chemical dependency, all of those pieces interrelate because we serve a client, a whole client. And so getting our industry centered around what is the best thing for the industry to survive, we're getting to that point. Mm-hmm. We're beginning to have discussions amongst ourselves before we come to you, kind of advocating for one piece of the industry over another. We're not there yet, and my advice to you would be to push us back to each other. How does that work with the hospitals? How does that work with the dentist? And I don't mind being asked that question. And I will go back to my peers, fellow lobbyists, and ask those questions. But I think that part of it is that as an industry, we are not working together.
And I think you're right on a number of points. The access to data and information is very difficult. We're going to be dealing with some questions about liability, tort reform, and it's hard, you know, when you look at some of the suggestions in this model that Jeff presented, to know what's the underlying assumption with respect to risk, and to what degree does risk and potential liability play a role in what assumptions have to be placed together in the financial model for any healthcare system, because those risks change depending on various practice areas that a physician may be in, and hospitals may have a very different experience with those things too. So, but it's hard to get data, because you talk to the trial lawyers and say, well, it's not us. You talk to the insurance industry and say, surely not us. You know, and it is pretty doggone hard to really put your finger on what the real problem is and how you can affect a solution without people coming to the table. So,
yes, Senator Fisher.
You know, that's that is a tough thing, and that's really where we get at this whole point of whether we're going to work together. The industries will survive because there is a need out there to have those things done. Ultimately, in some ways, it's not the industry that hurts as much as it is the individual person that needs that particular care when he's limited in what he has to actually work with to get it. I don't expect this to change much what the CEO of Ford Motor Company is going to be able to get for himself and his family and that kind of thing. But what I'm worried about it is, how does this hit the person that's just working to keep body and soul together and has a job that barely keeps him going? He's the one that's ultimately going to probably bear the biggest brunt of this type of thing. And the problem is that every single thing that we do and every decision we make deals with risk. Now, I've been in the long-term health care program for business for, in some way, form, or another for 35 years. And I watched this thing take place where first it was basically home, nursing home, and hospital. Then you began to get a few other things. Then we got our waivers and we started with a different community-based care. But I'm here to tell you, you take a risk being in the nursing home over being in the hospital. You take a risk in being in the hospital over being in intensive care. And so you go down the line, it's the same thing. You take a bigger risk of being in an assisted living facility than taking a nursing home. You take a bigger risk of being in an adult foster care home than you do from being in the assisted living facility. You take a bigger risk yet when you go to a retirement home instead of that. It's all based on what we're willing to pay for, how much risk we're willing to accept, and what our pocketbook will pay for. And that's the hardest thing in the world to find out when we're not sitting down and trying to get together with everybody in the process and saying, okay, we can give a little here, we can give a little there, we can take a little here, we can accept just a bit more risk here. And very definitely, don't tell me that insurance companies, the tort reform, pharmaceutical companies, everybody figures in a place in this risk process. And in a lot of cases, the government is continuing to push up the risk to a certain extent because they also are the ones that are doing permits. They're granting the right to put a drug on the market and all these kind of things. And I'm not sure that they're sitting down and saying, how can we expedite these processes in the very best way, still dealing with the fact that we have a risk? Because if we pull back any of those things that they required, basically we're going to have another risk.
and all those things have to be evaluated. Well, there's people out there saying, oh, we will accept no risk in the healthcare arena. We will get to top. We will have the Maserati or whatever you want of the system, period, for everybody concerned. Well, it isn't going to happen. And so how do we get together and how do we get down to the bare facts of what can we do to keep the best possible amount of people we can handle in the best possible shape that they can be in to live their lives and do their work? And that's basically where we're at right now. We're in basically, as far as I'm concerned, the World War II or the World War I of finance. And we may not be at war nationwide, but we're in that same position where we've got to entice and get everybody to cooperate and work together on this thing, or frankly, we're going to have some real, real, real sad things happen on one end of the spectrum or the other before it levels out.
Okay. And I guess I... Oh, go ahead. Did you want to respond?
No.
Okay. Well, And maybe it's kind of in keeping with that, because I'm bothered by this idea of what demand is. And I know from economics, demand is the ability to get something. Not, you know, people don't, when they measure the laws of supply and demand, they're not talking about the laws of supply and wish. They're talking about people who can afford to buy whatever it is you're selling. That's supply and demand. Now, what is... Is a healthcare demand and unmet? Can it be a demand when it's still okay? It's an unmet need that a person cannot afford. Now, economically, then that is not a demand. We make it a demand because we say, as a society, we're going to make it affordable. Is that what we're saying by demand?
Let me go back to here.
That's a myth.
That's a myth. Why is this not going where I want it to go? Go back to page 2.
Okay. That's where I was. Page 2. Demand.
Right.
Go back to the paper.
Go back to the paper, yeah. Technology.
Any condition that presents itself to the healthcare system for diagnosis and treatment economically is not okay.
Until it presents itself to the system, it's not a demand.
If it presents itself and nobody can afford it, that cannot be... Okay, morally it's a demand, economically it's not a demand.
No, if they can't afford it, then the question is whether or not it gets into the system. If it doesn't get into the system, it's not a demand. It only becomes a demand in terms of this definition when it gets into the system. At that point, it's a demand. Now, if I'm uninsured and I have a bad throat, let's say I can't afford it, so I call my doctor and I say, you know, I don't have any insurance, and they say, I'm sorry, we don't have any openings for an insured. And then I say, well, I don't want to go to the ER because I had a bad experience, so I don't go. And then then I wait. Well, if it turns into be strep and it ends up getting, say, into my heart and destroying a valve, then, which strep can do, then I end up in the hospital. That's where your demand starts in the definition of this model. Does that make sense?
Okay, you're arbitrarily, and you're put into the system where they have to care for you.
Correct.
Okay, there is a demand when a person doesn't get care and goes to the emergency room. That immediately creates a demand.
Correct.
Yeah, but, okay.
So it's the presentation to the system, to the healthcare system, is where the demand is. If you sit out there, you've got cultural things. Some people just sit home and take care of it themselves.
Yeah.
And they don't do anything other than, I mean, you could argue that buying chicken soup for a cold is actually a demand.
But you go to your car dealer and you say, I would like to have that car, and if you don't have the money, he says, that is not a demand. You go to the doctor and say, I would like to have the service, he can say, you don't have the money, you don't have a demand, go away.
Correct.
Okay. So demand is only once you enter the system. We're not talking...
Now, the difference between the two examples you gave, though, is because... you can go to another car dealer and look for, you know, a cheaper thing. But if you're sick, you can't just make your wish go away.
Okay, I guess what I'm getting at is that we can't design a system
to take care of human beings who we say have a right to health care if we are not willing to pay for it.
Correct.
And so
that I'd absolutely agree with that.
So Senator, we then are, in a sense, we are creating demands that otherwise might not exist. And I think that's part of the problem that people are having with, we need a copay so people won't be coming in and demanding things that are not demands.
Well, what your copay does, Senator, your copay directs people who have demands into certain areas of the system in terms of access. That's what a copay does. It doesn't mean whether you're sick or not, but it does have you make a decision as to whether you go here or whether you go there. Now, insurance, and this is one that comes up quite a bit, and you hear this, particularly with regard to this population, is that by merely providing insurance, you can actually set up a consumer expectation, you know, that they get to go access the system, even though their health care status wouldn't indicate that they needed to.
Right.
So you got two pieces of the demand. One is you've got health care status that will create a demand, or you've got consumer expectations that will create a demand. That make sense?
Well, as long as you're going to pay for it, I guess that's what...
Well, and what we want to do is we want to pay for the demand that's created by an actual health status and not by consumer expectations or desires.
Senator Shields.
Senator Fisher and I are both enjoying the fact that we missed the opportunity to create this clever little phrase that refers to the not the law of supply and demand, but the law of supply and wish. Never mind. You know what I'm saying. So while we're lamenting that we lacked your cleverness, I'm wanting to take a quantum leap at this point. And that would be to look at all of this kind of through the eyes of the Oregon Health Plan standard population and I think it's enough to make the whole population suicidal or something, just trying to contemplate it all and figure it out. And maybe, I guess, ignorance is bliss, because each person just plugs in at their little point of entry, if they can get entry, and they aren't aware of what's there. All I know is that in my district I have panicky people running around because they don't know what they're losing, when they're going to lose it, if they'll ever get it back. You know, I've got people that have gone to get eye exams right now knowing that they won't be able to purchase the glasses, but at least they got that before they lost, you know, their benefits and so on and so forth. I know it's a quantum leap, but do either of you want to wander off, Ruby, maybe, and talk about this for a minute?
Well, I think it might be, Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I think it might be beneficial, I'm going to check my watch, to kind of go back just a little bit to talk about the creation of this split benefit. And Senator Fisher and Senator Minnis talked about the growth of the Oregon Health Plan in terms of OHP's evolution and the waiver application steering committee that Senator Fisher served on. And at that particular juncture, we had no idea the state's financial situation was going to become as grim as it has. And neither did the federal government, because they began to offer waivers allowing us to do more things only if we expanded the number of people that we included in our Medicaid programs, in our Medicaid program. And so we set about doing that. I heard a legislator last week talk about the fact that government is slow but sure. And so we moved in that direction slowly but surely, and it took the waiver application, the legislature with 2519, the waiver application steering committee, and then a bunch of visits back and forth with the Fed, and then finally we've received our waiver. By that time, the state's economic forecast had really dimmed. And so that kind of brings you up to speed on kind of where this thing headed. And then our economy basically has gone to hell in a handbasket. And we have more unemployed people who are seeking services in the Oregon Health Plan.
And qualify
for the Oregon Health Plan. And so these are Oregonians who have worked very, very hard, and they've lost their jobs, and their families are struggling. And so they then qualified for the Oregon Health Plan, which has increased our numbers. And so at the time that we began talking about reducing benefits to these folks, we had not planned on the removal of mental health, chemical dependency, dental, prescription drugs for this second tier of folks on the Oregon Health Plan. And the name Oregon Health Plan Plus are all of the people who are categorical eligibles, and those are people who are blind, disabled, children, pregnant women, and the aged. And then the standard population are adults and couples without children. And so that standard population, which is a population that truly needs the assistance, these are people who have extremely low incomes. About 40% of those folks live at 10% of the poverty level. Many of them have mental illness, chemical dependency issues. They're transplant patients. I mean, there are reasons why people are low income. No one wakes up in the morning saying, I choose to be low income. So a lot of these folks have difficulties that by getting them back on the road, we can assist them in becoming viable taxpayers, is what I call it. So the goal was to reduce the benefit for those folks somewhat, but what we've done is we've had to reduce it and reduce it and reduce it. So November, the board made the decision to remove chemical dependency, mental health, and some of the DME, durable medical equipment, like oxygen, syringes for diabetes, a lot of the equipment. And then here coming up at March the 1st, we will completely eliminate the prescription drug benefit for these individuals. And I want to remind you that in this population of folks, we have people who are transplant patients, people who are HIV/AIDS patients, people who have diabetes and are on insulin. And a lot of these things are life-sustaining for these folks. So asthma, and I mean, you can just think of the trauma that's going on with this population of folks. And it's budget-driven. And we all know that it's budget-driven. And I think that the health plans like Care Oregon, we have 100,000 of these individuals on our health plan. And we will not be able to serve these people because there isn't enough money coming from the state to serve this population. And what it does is it puts at risk our other 75,000 members. We could sink our entire health plan trying to provide these folks with drugs, et cetera.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Ruby, you're absolutely right, but you're absolutely wrong. But well, it's not your fault.
I appreciate your comment.
Well, I said this in this committee before. It's a political problem that we have to address here. And for as much as we want to whine about the budget declining, the responsibility falls on our shoulders, and particularly when, and I've said this before, we're spending almost $2,000 more per child in the public education system, and we don't ask why. And we have succumbed to the seduction of education is good for education's sake, and therefore more money means better education, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that paradigm and that assumption is wrong. And I think when we get to first principles and what the role of the government is and what our responsibilities are, and did it in 1993, our first responsibility is the protection of those individuals who cannot protect themselves. That includes the persons that you're talking about. And what we have today is a legislature that is coming in on the heels of an era within which education funding was premier. And it won out. It won the political discussions to the point of ridiculousness, in my opinion. But we, as legislators and as a legislature, are unwilling to confront that difficulty. So we can whine about it or not. And somebody asked me yesterday from the ESD, he said, what is the biggest obstacle in Oregon to getting more revenue for schools? And I said, because that's the last thing on my mind. You know, my heart is with the people that are going to get their medicines cut off, that are getting put into, you know, to housing that disrupts their entire world. That's where my heart's at. And I don't even want to talk about education, because I think it's disingenuous to those populations to even do that at this point. But we need to confront those issues. But I told this fellow, I said, the problem is the people of the state of Oregon. You've got to convince them.
Well, I won't get into ballot measure 5 and the cost shifts from the locals to the state, which didn't pay their way before ballot measure 5. I won't get into that.
Well, but I'm just saying that's
the
today.
Okay, but I guess we're talking about an adequate funding for health care for the people who need it, which I support.
First
now,
principle.
We do have one other testimony of an individual who drove all the way up here, and I do want to allow time at the end of some of these meetings to hear from constituents or from the public in general. But
I was just going to say back up what Senator Minnis said concerning the situations of priorities and things like that. The problem we faced on that waiver application or the waiver application steering committee was basically a difference in philosophy. A philosophy of wanting government to provide everything against a philosophy trying to utilize all the means that we had at hand to supply these things, including going out and partnering with the private sector for insurance policies and things like that, no matter how small. And if you go back to the intent of Measure 2519, or House Bill 2519, you'll find that waiver application followed very little of 2519's thrust. And so we denied ourselves of that, centering on all kinds of pie-in-the-sky co-pays and things like that basically were not enforced, so that they just merely made it harder on the provider and supplier, and we're facing that today as an outfall of that, and we need to go back and adjust that. I'm trying not to dwell on what's been in the past. I'm trying to dwell on what we have to accomplish in the future. The past is behind us, however rugged and however miserable it was and however misguided were the efforts. But we've got to change that, and we've got to engender every help we can get. And I don't care if somebody gets $5 a month of health insurance through a private entity that he's working for, he better take that and help us out with that $5 a month or $10, whatever we can get. If it only buys a particular amount of drugs, or if it just takes care of a major something that happens in the way of a cancer, a transplant, or something like that. Anything that we can get the private sector to do and accomplish, and the people to do on their own, we have to engender that and work it in some way. And that's what we've had frustrations in trying to do. It's been either basically government doing it all, or we don't get it. And so I want to work, and I'm looking very much forward toward being able to work with all the people concerned so that we can come up with the best possible thing using every resource that we have at our disposal in order to do it, and not just picking on one particular interest or building up a great big bureaucracy to do something we don't have to do.
The only caveat I would add is that people who ignore history are bound to repeat it. You know, you're going to repeat yourself, and in terms of making the same mistakes. But I agree, we can't dwell on the past, but we certainly have to look back and figure out what we might have done.
Learn from the past. I said dwell on the past, and
that. No, I agree. We can't. But yes, you had something else that you were about to say.
I was going to say one thing, and it's because Senator Fisher raised the issue of you know, the private industry. I would say to the committee that one of the things that you did with the Oregon Health Plan was you essentially privatized the delivery of care, and that frankly is one of the hallmarks of how the Oregon Health Plan has actually worked well. And I'll have that conversation with you a little later, Senator Minnis. And I would make as an editorial comment that one of the reasons why we're in the pickle that we're in is because certain areas of state government have forgotten that they asked the private industry to do a job, and then when we got into this budget crunch, they forgot that we were doing the job and that we actually have the best information as to how they can make some changes. And, you know, to put it in not artful terms, the delivery system has been left out of most of these discussions.
That's why you're here.
And that's why we're here today, and we appreciate very much being here. And we hope that we can be a resource to you as we move forward.
The next time you come, I would like you to keep your lobby hat on and tell us what you think we need to do more specifically, because you gave us a pretty good overview, but you were kind of careful not to.
I want to be as objective.
I know you did, but I think that there's a place for that, and then there is also a place for coming to us as someone who has a vast experience and making some recommendations.
And be more than happy to do that.
Okay. So that's
okay. Anyway, thank you for your time. If there aren't any other questions, Bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, one of the things that we neglected to do is to leave a little bit of time on the end for individuals who wanted to testify, and we were contacted by Lucy Kingsley. Lucy, would you come up? And you did, and so you do have 5 minutes or whatever you need to give us your concerns, please, because I think it's important that we hear from.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Morissette. I hope I don't cry, but I might. My name is Lucy Kingsley, and I have been a provider of mental health crisis services to Lane County for over 30 years. At present, I am a staff person for Lane County Mental Health, and up until yesterday, part of what I did was work in the emergency room at Sacred Heart Hospital, providing psychiatric consultations to the emergency room physicians. Another part of my job is to work as a screener for Lane County Mental Health, taking in calls from people who are requesting services. I just wanted to give you some I feel like I'm operating in a war zone where people that I have dedicated my professional life to serve are dying and becoming gravely ill. The kinds of situations I am having to say, I'm sorry, I can't serve you, I can't provide you with care, are things like a young man having his first psychotic break who injects himself with engine degreaser because he thinks that that'll help his body function better. Women who are so depressed after having babies that they can't nurse their children, and who are hearing voices telling them that they need to die or they need to kill their children. People who are cutting and burning themselves because they feel like they have done something bad, and that's why they're losing their benefits, because they personally have been bad. This is not why I entered the field. One of the things we got asked to do at work was to make a list from our caseloads of the people that we thought, if they lost their benefits, would become lethal. People who I thought might take their lives if they lost their benefits. I have clients who are seriously head injured. some of whose medications costs are over $3,000. These are people whose income is maybe $600 a month max. These are people who are losing access to their medications. If you're talking about cost other than cost in economic terms, the tragedy and the devastation on these people's lives. Is overwhelming. There is grave concern at the mental health division on the staff level that we won't even be in operation after the end of June. Because there won't be the money to fund the services. There is grave concern among providers within for mental health services and like the private nonprofit counseling facilities, the residential facilities, that there will be so much infighting over what little money is left that providing services to the needs of the people will just sort of not be acknowledged. This is the worst I have ever seen this in the over 30 years that I've been doing this work. And I just... I try to have faith in the work that I do as a crisis worker. I try to have a focus that in the midst of great chaos and in the midst of great danger, there is opportunity. But from where I sit and where I work, it sure looks bleak. And it's very frightening in terms of the cost that this is having on the lives of the people that I'm trying to serve.
Kingsley, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And it's very important to put a face on the decisions that are made in this body. And I would submit to you that, and I've chaired the Ways and Means Committee before and served in Ways and Means. I'm familiar with existing budget crisis, quote unquote. We have the resources to deal with the issue. But the problem is a political problem right now. And that's a sad, sad statement, but it is a truth. And again, this body will have to shore up the courage to deal with the issue, and it's going to have to happen soon. And just as you know, I do have another rule prepared, a rule change for the Senate that will require a Senate vote on House Bill 5075, which restores the funding to this program. It's been held up, and it's in Ways and Means, and people who assumedly are smarter than me are trying to figure out how they're going to manipulate their way through this. But as far as I'm concerned, as a politician, experienced politician, the bill needs to be voted on. The services need to be guaranteed as soon as possible. And I think the governor needs to come out with a strong statement. I've made that statement to them. I've sent that message to them and met with their office today, suggesting that that statement needs to be made. And I will submit to it and say it publicly. It needs to be made. It needs to be made quickly because those clients that you're serving, in fact, are suffering. So I appreciate what you're saying.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Fisher.
I truly appreciate you coming here and sharing your experiences with us, but I would also ask you in the process, how much administration have you lost in Lane County? And how many of them are working in a way that they're making it easier for Lane County to help out in some of these issues as far as as getting together and working to help the overall county funding problem. Are we seeing any efforts whatsoever by any personnel to share their part of the load? Are they looking out at the private and nonprofit sector, and the taxpayer basically is being the only one that needs to cut back in their salaries and things like that in order to keep a business going? That's a problem, part of the problem as I see it. You have a situation where administration is basically saying, we'll cut these programs, but are they willing to be doing any cutting in their own bailiwick? And that I don't see.
Well, I know, for example, within our own department that several of our administrators do not work at full time, for example. I mean, I don't know if that really answers.
Is that a cutback from what they were doing?
Yes.
And a total cutback, or are they just doing in other areas? Are they taking less salary?
Well, they're. I mean, they take less salary because they're working fewer hours. I guess I'm not. Maybe I'm not understanding your question,
well,
Senator.
What I'm saying is, you know, this has got to be a shared thing.
Yes.
And we also have to start looking to what actual needs are rather than perceived needs and some things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have to make some of those decisions because, you see, even as bad off as we think we are here, we've got a ton of nations around this world that are working under a whole lot worse circumstances, and there are people under a whole lot worse circumstances than we are,
yeah.
even in the bad situation
yes.
we're in right now.
Yes.
But it's something, again, that... and I know from the legislative intent of even Senate Bill 5100 or House Bill 5100, we had no intention of picking on the programs that hurt people the worst to make the cuts in just to scare some more money out of the people. That was not the intent of that bill.
I understand that.
Okay. Good.
Thank you.
We are an industrialized nation, and when you compare our health care with other industrialized nations, it's not really good. If you compare us with Afghanistan or some of those countries, it's probably pretty good. I think that this is, unfortunately, does involve philosophic, economic differences in the legislature in terms of what the problem is to start with, what the solution is. So there, you're right. Yeah, my colleagues are right. There are some differences of opinion, and you know, I'm not sure how we're going to resolve this ultimate issue. I'm hoping that we do come up with money to deal with the most vulnerable people in our society, and I do support the effort to put the money back into those programs. Although I don't know where it's going to come from when we make the next billion-dollar cut next biennium, unless we have a new source of revenue, which I'm suggesting. Now, we can get into whether or not it's an education problem, it's a healthcare problem, but you obviously can see some of the differences
yes.
of approach.
Yes.
Demand is the ability to pay, but I think there is a moral demand to take care of the needs of people.
Yes, I would agree with you, sir.
Anyway. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Lucy.
Now let's go to the Education Committee and have it out over there.
Let's do it.